especially in Al-Quds. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether this Al-Quds Day will mobilize Palestinian supporters in mass and around the world to highlight the suffering of Palestinians at the hands of the Israeli regime. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mick Napier joins us. He's an activist and commentator who joins us from Edinburgh. Also joining us is Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Zafar Bangash, first to you. The last day of the holy month of Ramadan, as I'm sure you are aware, is called International Al-Quds Day, a day that's deemed really important when it comes to the Palestinian cause. We're looking at the importance that obviously has every year. Some are saying this year's rally is supposed to be very significant. Do you think that is? And what are your thoughts when you think about the significance of Al-Quds Day?
First of all, Al-Quds Day has been declared the last Friday of Ramadan by the late Imam Khomeini as far back as 1980. And today we see that millions of people around the world participate in these rallies. Now this year, it's going to be particularly significant because due to the pandemic over the last 2 years in many parts of the world, Quds Day rallies could not be held physically, although in some parts of the world they were still held, but they were not held, for instance, in North America because of this pandemic restrictions and so on. So many people are looking forward to this year's Quds Day. That's the first point. Secondly, we see that in this Ramadan, again, the Zionists have been violating the sanctity of Masjid al-Aqsa. They've been barging into the holy sanctuary and attacking Palestinians. That obviously has caused a lot of anguish and grief and annoyance among many, many people around the world. And we know that, for instance, with respect to the Zionist policies, they did the same thing last year, which led to an 11-day attack by the Zionists on the Gaza Strip. But this year, of course, again, the Zionists have been attacking the Masjid al-Aqsa. Palestinians have been attacked and shot even inside the Masjid. Tear gas shells have been fired. All kinds of other atrocities have been committed. There have been horrific images of worshippers being attacked, their hands and feet being tied. Even women and children are attacked, and scores of people have been killed throughout this month. So obviously, this is a major concern to people that feel for the plight of the Palestinian people, and they want to make sure that they express their concern for what is going on in Palestine, both in terms of the continued illegal occupation of Masjid al-Aqsa, as well as the brutalities that the Zionists are inflicted upon them. So we are expecting massive rallies this year all over the world, particularly in North America and Europe, where incidentally rallies take place not just in one city or one country, but several cities in each country, which indicates that this issue is now becoming a global issue and people are more and more aware of what the Zionists are doing.
Well, it's interesting, Mick Napier, I don't know if you agree or not, that we saw how Israel actually chose this year to desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque in the way that it did, in the severity of the way it applied violence. We heard about, for example, for the first time, it used drones to, I guess, spray over the Palestinians, including what happened in Al-Aqsa, which is really sacrilegious in terms of handcuffing people with these Tyvek and shooting rubber bullets at them. Some have said to exploded inside Palestinians, special type of bullets. Anyways, this actually gave a momentum, it appears, to what's going to happen in Al-Quds Day, because there were so many protests that happened prior in just the past few days. Do you think that there will be a bigger momentum this year based on what Israel did at Al-Quds regarding the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
I mean, several things point in that direction. One is the desperation of Palestinians living in a pressure cooker where the Zionist crimes on relatively quiet days continue. But the Israeli state has intensified the repression this Ramadan, and it's not an accident. Last year, as the other speaker, your other guest pointed out, there was a very intense confrontation. But the key thing is that Israel didn't win. They threw families out onto the street in East Jerusalem. There were killings and shootings and beatings across the West Bank. Inside 48 last year, fascist gangs or extreme right-wing gangs, nationalist Jewish gangs, were hunting Palestinians and beating them up for the crime of being Palestinians. And the resistance firing rockets from Gaza somehow brought together the combination of resistance and different types of resistance brought Palestinians together in a very new way. And so when those 11 days were over, Israel hadn't won, and Israel knew that it hadn't won. It knew that its effort to crush Palestinian resistance had been successful. And therefore, it was clear this Ramadan they would try to win a very decisive victory by intensifying the repression. And the disgusting things that are happening in the Al-Aqsa Mosque are one aspect of intensified repression across the whole of Palestine. Some on the extreme right wing, who usually set the tone for future developments in Israel, have praised Netanyahu for opening up Al-Aqsa Mosque to extremist Jewish settlers. And they are now calling for the restoration of animal sacrifice right throughout the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So the threat to the Al-Aqsa Mosque is very real. It's intensified from the Israeli side, also because they feel confident. They have allies in Abu Dhabi, in Morocco, in Egypt, in Oman, in Saudi Arabia, for sure, under the table. And therefore, they think that these alliances give them overwhelming power and that the Palestinians are completely isolated at the level of Arab governments. But they leave aside, they don't take into consideration the power of ordinary people and resistance in all its forms across the Middle East. So I think that the demonstrations this year, I was on a large one in London last Sunday, the demonstrations should be large, should be big, and I think they will be a tribute to Palestinian resistance under incredible pressure in the most, I would argue, the most unequal anti-colonial struggle in history, because the Palestinians face the US, the EU, Britain, etc., and these various Arab states. So the demonstrations are extremely important for one reason, if I can just make one more point. Palestinians are desperate. They are facing an overwhelming military power. But when you see that you're not alone, when you see the power of people coming together around the world in your support, it raises the morale of Palestinians and it damages the morale of the Zionist bloc. And therefore, these demonstrations are very, very important.
In terms of what our guest there, Zafar Bangash, pointed to, and that is how some Arab regimes, if you want to call them, or countries that have formalized their ties with Israel, at least coming out, so to speak, out of the closet on this. Iran's leader has made a statement, and he said just a couple days back, quote, "Unfortunately, Muslim governments are acting very badly vis-a-vis Palestine. They're not even willing to talk about the Palestinian issue, and that some of them imagine that establishing relations with the Zionists is the way to help Palestine. Well, this is a big mistake. Why do you think the Arab leaders went ahead and actually abided by what was a U.S. brokered initiative, knowing that it's going to have a backlash not only against from their own population, but also in terms of the way that they have stabbed the Palestinians in the back?
Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that these Arab regimes don't have leaders, they have rulers. Leaders are people that are supposed to be elected and supported by their people. In none of these regimes that you know, your other guest mentioned and you mentioned, any of these regimes or the rulers have been elected by the people or given a mandate by the people. So as far as the masses in the Arab world are concerned, they are completely opposed to their regimes. They do not support their policies. There may be one or two, perhaps, or one or two areas where perhaps the people are unable to express their anger properly because they are so much oppressed. Like, you know, you can look at the situation in Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. But in other places, whether it's Egypt or Jordan or Morocco, people are expressing their outrage at the way the Zionists are brutalizing the Palestinian people. Now, with respect to these regimes and the policies that they have adopted, unfortunately, these regimes, as I mentioned, are illegitimate. They don't have the support of their masses. They feel that the United States is gradually pulling out of the region, so they want to secure the other line of defense, and that is to cling to the Zionist regime in the hope that the Zionist regime would perhaps provide them some protection. The Zionist regime itself is not secure. I think we should be very clear about it. Because of the fact that the Palestinian people have not given up despite all of these decades of Zionist oppression, this in itself is a great victory for the Palestinian people. Secondly, we must keep in mind that 2021, that is last year, when the Zionists launched their barbaric missile attacks on the Gaza Strip, they did not dare invade the Gaza Strip with their ground troops because the Israeli military commanders pointed and told the regime in Tel Aviv that if we carry out a ground invasion, we will not be able to control the situation because the Palestinians have risen up even inside what is referred to as the Green Line. So there was a unity among the Palestinians from last year, and that unity is continuing this year, despite the fact that Palestinians are suffering tremendously in Jerusalem, in Masjid al-Aqsa and Jenin and other parts of West Bank. But the moral high ground is still held by the Palestinian people. And so all of these other activities that these Arabian regimes are indulging in trying to cozy up to the Zionists, will not provide them any security. It is not going to solve the problem of the Palestinian people or the rights of the Palestinian people, because the more these regimes cozy up and align and embrace the Zionist monstrosity, the more anger it would arouse among the people worldwide. I also want to say that, you know, now there are, of course, millions of people in other parts of the world, especially in the Muslim world, whether it's in Iran or Pakistan or Turkey, Malaysia. You can even go into the African countries. You know, there are going to be Quds Day rallies in many, many African countries, including in several cities in South Africa, in Tanzania, in Kenya. So you can see that this is becoming a global phenomenon. And Muslims and non-Muslims all around the world, whether here in Canada, where I am based, or in the north of, or in the United States, many Christian groups and Jewish groups are joining these Quds Day rallies because they are fed up of the Zionist crimes. The Jewish groups in particular, they are appalled by the atrocities that the Zionists are committing in their name. So they say, not in our name. They do not wish to have anything to do with this these Zionist crimes. So sure. It seems to me that globally, this phenomenon is growing, and this should provide comfort and support and confidence to the Palestinian people to continue their struggle.
Well, McNapier, our guest there mentioned something that is really important to bring out here and have your reaction to, and that is the fact that when we look at what happened last Ramadan regarding the violence and the desecration of the mosque, it led to that war, of which we saw two very important things. One, that the rocket range was able to penetrate Israel like never before with their so-called Iron Dome failing. But another very important factor that our guests there talked about is how that within the occupied West Bank in many areas you had infighting between the Arab Palestinians and then the Israelis, which is said to be two reasons why Israel did not wage a war against the Gaza Strip this time around, because it was afraid of those two reasons. Is that a correct analysis or feel on why Israel did not go through with the war on Gaza this time around?
Look, Israel's very cruel, and they have a long-term goal of a Palestine which is free of all Palestinians. But they're very strategic, and they're very alert to how far they can go without causing trouble for their patrons. The Americans and the British will let them go very far, but they'll pull on their chain if they begin to cause real trouble with the populations around the world. And, you know, it's not the side, in an anti-colonial struggle, it's not the side which has the big weapons which wins. You know, the French were massively superior militarily to the Algerian resistance. But it was Algerian people rising in their huge numbers who finally expelled the French colonialists. And I think what your other guest has said is right. It may seem a little bit fanciful sometimes, but it really is popular opinion around the world which can put a constraint on what Israel does. Because, you know, there are 2 billion Muslims in the world, and there are maybe 5 or even 6 million Zionist Jews in Palestine at the moment, and a similar number of Palestinians. So the Israelis always put their finger to the wind. Which way is the wind blowing? How far can... They're very brutal, they're genocidal, they're committed to trying to crush Palestinian resistance. The problem is the Palestinians keep resisting. I mean, by any rational measure, they should give up because they're against such overwhelming opposition, but they keep resisting. As long as they keep resisting, Israel feels fragile. You know, it makes me laugh sometimes. A couple of years ago, a few Palestine activists put, 100 posters up on the London Metro overnight. The ambassador was called in. Netanyahu contacted Boris Johnson, I think, or the Prime Minister at the time. They were agitated over a few people putting a few posters up in a London metro system. They feel very fragile. They know what they have done. They know that they're a minority sort of crusader state, an extension of Europe into the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And although they play in the European Cup and they play in various different European games, they know that their future there is not secure. About 40% of Israelis have 2 passports. And if you measure Israeli opinion, especially among some young people, it's very fragile. They're sure. Not as confident as they try to appear.
Okay.
And Palestinian resistance is the key to the whole thing.
Zafar Bangash, in conclusion, the Iranian proposal has been reiterated many times, and that is the fact that Iran has said, and I'm looking at a variety of officials, even as far back as 4 hours ago, where you had the Iranian president calling for a Palestinian referendum, including for Palestinians who are outside of the land of Palestine. It's a fair proposal. It's logical. What do you think? 30 seconds.
Oh, absolutely. I think if there is going to be a solution short of an absolutely brutal war, then a referendum is the way to go. And I'm absolutely convinced that the Zionists cannot win a military war, not because they don't have the weapons, not because they don't have larger forces, etc., but because the Palestinians refuse to surrender. And so long as the Palestinians refuse to surrender, the Zionists simply cannot win. They cannot wipe out all the Palestinians. So the referendum is the way to go, and that's the only way to ascertain the future of that holy land.
Thank you for that, Zafar Bangash, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Mick Napier, thank you for your input, activist and commentator from Edinburgh. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tatway. It's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, developing Islamic lifestyle through Shahr Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has informed us of how to shape our lives and develop Islamic lifestyle through the blessings of the blessed month of Ramadan. Let's learn from the best. Verily, the month of Allah is approaching you with blessings, mercy, and forgiveness, a month which is the best month in Allah's view. Its days are the best days, and its nights are the best nights, and its hours are the best hours. It is a month in which you are invited to be Allah's guests and chosen to be of those with divine honor. Your breathing in this month is counted as tasbih, and your sleep as worship. Your rituals are accepted and your prayers are granted. So ask Allah, your Lord, with a sincere intention and a purified heart, to give you good luck for fasting and reciting His book. Since unlucky is the one who misses God's forgiveness in such a great month. Brothers and sisters, Allah's mercy is at your disposal. Allah wants to forgive you. You just need to turn to Him. And it's not difficult. Of course, Shaitan is going to make it look like a daunting task, something that you cannot for the life of you achieve. It's not like that. Allah is waiting for His servants. And what better month there is than the month of mercy, than the month of Ramadan, for you to turn back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and connect back to Him. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the Islamic lifestyle, the Islamic viewpoint, through Shahr Ramadan and how we are supposed to develop that lifestyle and viewpoint. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "Remember, while you are hungry and thirsty, the hunger and the thirst of the hereafter. Pay charity to the poor and the needy. Respect your elders and be kind to the younger. Visit your relatives. Save your tongue from what you are not supposed to say, your eyes from what you're not supposed to look at, and your ears from what you're not supposed to listen to." Brothers and sisters, these are those reminders that we all need, and I need them more than every one of you. Isn't it the time now that we start listening to these divine teachings of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam? This is the time where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He is expecting us to open up our hearts to the teachings, the divine teachings of Allah and Prophet. If we are able to do it in this month, great. But if we miss this month,
we don't even know if we're going to witness another month of Ramadan next year or not. So consider it to be a chance, a mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that He is giving His servant to come back to Him, turn back to Him, and change for good. You know, all of these things that are mentioned, our conscience and our soul and our subconscious, all of it bears testimony that these are good things. So why in the world would we deprive ourselves of adopting these good things?
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Imam Khomeini said, "The racist Zionist regime has always been a source of discord among regional states."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
With the re-election of President Emmanuel Macron, France's mainstream media has stopped worrying about fascism and started to honestly discuss the state of the country. A France divided is the most common headline. In 2017, Macron promised to not give France a reason to vote for the extremes of the political spectrum, but the far right and the far left have both grown to new highs.
It's a good thing Macron was re-elected. We need a young, efficient, pro-European president with a long-term vision. I'm surprised at the high score for the National Front, but in their economic program, they forget that it's the bosses who are in charge of salaries and not the president.
Le Pen won just 5% of the vote in the capital, while out of 101 departments, she carried 30 of them, mostly rural. She secured just one department in 2017. 80% of voters described the presidential campaign as being of poor quality, and few desired a rematch of 2017.
I didn't vote in the second round. In the first round, I voted for third place finisher Jean-Luc Mélenchon and decided to abstain. I think it's better that Macron won instead of Le Pen, who is too extreme right for me.
Macron's problem is that, once again, he can't claim his win signifies a broad mandate for his proposals. Subtract 39% of the total electorate due to abstention and purposely spoiled ballots, and Macron's 58% of the vote falls to just 35% of the electorate. If we fairly assume that, like in 2017, 43% of his voters only did so to block Le Pen, then just 20% of the total electorate chose Macron for his policies or personality. That's a drop of 4 points from 2017. If Macron continues to rule as if his policies don't need a broad popular mandate, then France's permanent social unrest seems likely to continue.
A Le Pen victory would have set off immediate protests, but for now, a calm resignation is reigning. However, few expect the Paris street or the rural roundabout to remain quiet for very long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of this international conference that drew political figures and activists from across the world to Tehran to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their struggle against Israel's occupation.
The message of the conference here is for expressing unity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters who are suffering and who are struggling for their independence and their sovereignty.
The centrality of the issue of Palestine for the Muslim world is what we want to remind some of the Arab states that ignored this fact and contemptibly normalized their ties with the criminal regime of Israel despite the will of their nations. Some Arab leaders must be ashamed even more now when we see that the Israelis are attacking Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Israeli forces have repeatedly attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound site since early April, with the onset of the holy month of Ramadan, which coincided with Jewish Passover. Last week, more than 150 Palestinian worshippers were injured when Israeli forces stormed the compound in the occupied city of Al-Quds. The regime has pressed ahead with its violence in the Flashpoint site and has been cracking down on solidarity protests throughout the occupied West Bank.
What is happening today in Palestine has been repeated for the last 72 years. Added to that, that today the crimes of Israel has exceeded all the human rights and all war crimes. UNESCO itself has declared that Al-Aqsa Mosque is an Islamic sanctity, is an Islamic place. It has nothing related to the Jewish religion. What is the relevance to the extreme Zionist Jewish settlers to get into the mosque and pray over there? There is no relation to them over there. What we want today is that the international community has to understand that Israel has violated the freedom of worshipping rights.
This conference is held ahead of the International Quds Day, a global pro-Palestine rally that takes place every year on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan. Activists here regard Quds Day as an opportunity to shed light on the Israeli crimes in Palestine and hope that it would instigate the international community to take action in support of Palestinians.
Delegates here say Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, calling on Muslims worldwide to participate in the International Quds Day en masse. They say this is the only way to bring the Palestinian cause to light, amid attempts by Tel Aviv to sweep its crimes under the rug. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The EU and its Western allies continue to pour hundreds of millions of euro worth of deadly weapons into Ukraine. Speaking in India on Monday, the head of the bloc's executive arm, Ursula von der Leyen, defended this policy.
Our response to Russia's aggression today will decide the future of both the international system and the global economy.
Just last week in the European Parliament, a number of legislators questioned the wisdom of pumping lethal weapons into Ukraine.
If there is a ceasefire, who's going to disarm those individuals who are receiving these arms? We know how weapons sent to fight al-Assad in Syria ended up being used for attacks in other countries.
Also, it's clear many EU citizens are against the enormous militarization of Ukraine by the West.
If you send weapons, maybe you will encourage the conflict.
We all must hope the world need peace.
I think the peace is the best way.
Weapon is not the answer to nothing.
Poverty is on the rise in the EU, and so campaigners say the huge amounts of money being spent on providing weapons for the conflict could be better spent.
People are faced with the COVID crisis, you know, with energy crisis, you know, the bills of people are tripled or even quadrupled. So it's something ununderstandable.
But the European Commission insists the arming of Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict.
The war can stop today if Russia decides that it should stop. It has nothing to do with the arms deliveries to Ukraine. Ukraine is only defending itself.
However, a growing number of civil society organisations and lawmakers believe the West should be prioritising peace talks over arms delivery. Otherwise, they suggest, there is no way of ending this conflict. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hundreds of protesters flocked to central London on Sunday to honour the call of International Quds Day. The annual event, held on the last weekend of Ramadan, was initiated by the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979 to express solidarity for Palestinians and staunch opposition to Zionism.
Israeli aggression against Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan has become so regular that it's turned almost regrettably into an annual tradition. That's why tensions are so high this year, as continued aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is ongoing even at the time of this recording.
Due to its popularity, many attempts have been made by pro-Israel groups to ban the rally, with critics citing anti-Semitism accusations. Event supporters, however, rubbished these claims.
The Al-Quds demonstration is in support of the Palestinians in their fight against Zionism. Zionism is a totally different philosophy to Judaism. Zionism is a false, secular philosophy. Judaism is an age-old religion. Being against Zionism is being against falsehood. Nothing to do with anti-Semitism at all.
The very fact that the protest movement is being criminalised and there are efforts to ban it, I think that speaks volumes. They don't want concepts of resistance to be spoken about. Like, I'm not sure if you realise, in some of the protests, there's an emphasis on 1, 2, 3, 4, occupation no more, but not an emphasis on 5, 6, 7, 8, Israel is a terrorist state, right? It's like, we have solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians. We call out their victimhood, but we also target the aggressor.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque compound has been at the centre of weeks of heightened Israeli violence against Palestinian worshippers since the beginning of the Holy Month. With at least 19 Palestinians killed so far, fears remain high that another full-scale war could break out as Gaza's resistance threatens greater retaliation. Robert Carter, London.
Amid the Israeli escalation against Palestinians, Yemenis have held a conference called Palestine, the Central Cause of the Nation, in the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Senior officials have participated in the event to express their support for Palestinians.
The conference was held in Sana'a, the capital, which represents a symbol of steadfastness and resistance in the face of those who normalize relations with the Israeli enemy. The Yemeni people are a living example of free people, as the central issue for us is Palestine. If Yemen was still ruled by the previous regime, it would have been portrayed as having normalized relations with Israel. But praise be to God, the Yemeni people have been liberated.
Organizers said this conference is a preparation for the celebration of the International Quds Day, as Yemenis will fill the streets of Sana'a to prove their solidarity with the Palestinian cause.
This conference comes as part of preparations for marking Quds Day, which will be unprecedented this year, as the Yemeni people will come out to confirm that Palestine is the central issue of the nation. The message that we are sending through this conference is that the Yemeni people, with all their sects and components, insist that the Palestinian cause is the basis for the solution to all the problems facing the Islamic nation.
During the conference, the president of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashata, called for forming official and popular funds to support the Palestinian people and returning the Palestinian issue to the curricula to emphasize its importance for all generations.
Despite everything that is currently happening in the world and the catastrophic situation in the country, people who say they will never forget the Palestinian cause, they say it is the time for the free people of the world to prove their support for Palestinians against ongoing Israeli crimes. Al-Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israel, since its creation, has always touted itself as invincible, especially because of possessing advanced weapons and receiving unwavering military, intelligence, and financial support from the West, in particular the United States. Nonetheless, the myth of Israel's invincibility has been shattered over the past years as the regime suffered severe blows in the face of fierce resistance by the Palestinians, both in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Irrespective of the casualties Israeli forces have sustained in the West Bank in response to their crimes against Palestinians, retaliatory attacks in Israeli cities have turned the spotlight on the regime's vulnerability. Since March 22nd this year, Palestinians have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations in Israel, including one in Tel Aviv, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Such retaliatory operations reflect the fact that Israel will have to brace itself for an armed resistance inside its cities. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, the regime's spying fiasco also made headlines after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's much-vaunted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. But such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September 2021, six Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Likewise, a spate of successful hacking attacks, which have broken into the servers of major Israeli companies, further expose the weakness of the regime's intelligence service. But resistance against Israel is not restricted to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank alone. Other resistance groups, such as Lebanon's Hezbollah, have dealt severe blows to the regime in response to its acts of aggression. The multifaceted attacks against Israel have devastated the regime's illusion of invincibility and its dreams of ruling from the Nile to the Euphrates.
The 16th session of the Quds Conference for Palestinian Youth was held in Damascus. Participants discussed means of uniting Palestinians in service of their cause, hailing resistance operations in occupied Palestine and the people's uprising in the face of Israeli forces.
Our message in this conference is that Palestinian youth outside Palestine are present on the front lines, just like the youth in Quds, Gaza and the West Bank. Palestinians are uniting. The Sword of Palestine battle reflects this unity, and this conference is one of the results of that battle.
The conference is held in parallel with the International Al-Quds Day, which was set by late Imam Khomeini on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan every year.
The message of Iran on Quds Day is that the only path for regaining Palestinian rights is resistance against the crimes of the Zionist entity. The message of Quds International Day is Islamic unity in the face of Israeli crimes. The track of normalization will not affect regaining Palestinians' rights.
We as Palestinian, Syrian and Arab youth send a message to our people in Quds in Aqsa Mosque that we will support them until the liberation of Palestine, from the sea to the river. Thanks to the Resistance Alliance, today we are more capable of triumphing. And as Imam Khamenei said, Quds will remain the axis.
The final communique called for national unity among all Palestinian factions, as well as re-establishing the PLO with a national plan based on resistance against the Israeli enemy. Events like this reiterate that Palestinian refugees across the world will never give up their right of repatriation. It's a message to Israel that their struggle will never stop until ending the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
French President Emmanuel Macron has been re-elected in a comfortable victory, defeating the National Rally's Marine Le Pen, just like in 2017. 6 years after Brexit and the election of Donald Trump, France has still not had a shock victory which opposes right-wing economics and globalization. Macron's victory will be celebrated by high finance in Brussels and by the so-called bourgeois bloc, who are his core supporters. However, the Yellow Vests have said for months that they view a Macron victory as intolerable and as a call to social battle.
We had 3 years of a struggle but couldn't get Macron out of power. It shows that there is no solution possible by the ballot, only on the streets. Many people will be quite desperate, so things could turn towards extreme social instability and maybe civil war.
Le Pen did see a major rise in support as compared with 2017, but the nationalist bloc still fell short. It seems that many voters simply could not vote in favor of even a rebranded National Front, whose far-right record goes back decades. Abstention hit 28%, the highest since 1969. Blank or purposely spoiled ballots are estimated to be an additional 12%. The populist bloc, who apparently wanted neither candidate, made their presence felt by denying Macron a convincing victory in terms of the overall electorate.
The biggest revolution to come will be philosophical and intellectual. We need a new way of thinking, a new way of being French, and we need a new France. With Le Pen or Macron, we were sure to lose our democratic rights and personal freedoms, and that's unacceptable to many.
Just like in 2017, Macron is likely to face calls that his victory is not a mandate for his proposed policies, such as raising the retirement age this fall. That means the country is likely to experience continued social unrest, which was unprecedented in Macron's first term. France's political future usually first surfaces in their neo-imperial colonies, like with the Yellow Vests. For the first time, the far right won most of France's overseas territories in what could be a preview of 2027. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents and some their children. Here, we are meeting the family of Shahid Milad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Milad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Milad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on the school students, Mir Hussein went to bring his son home, but he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father. Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds. These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight.
Emmanuel Macron may have retained the presidency, as results for the second and final round of voting indicate. But the French people have lost the elections, which featured the lowest turnout since 1969 vote. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is titled, A Weaker Macron Boon to World Peace. Here's the story. Emmanuel Macron may have retained the presidency as results for the second and final round of voting indicate, but the French people have lost the elections, which featured the lowest turnout since 1969 vote. The controversial figure that he is, Macron will not have a smooth ride as the Élysée Palace in the next 5 years, in view of the parliamentary polls next month, where the far right, which improved its tally of votes in the presidential elections that it lost, is expected to dominate the chamber and block his bills. The growing number of the 6 million-odd French Muslim citizens, however, should not consider the loss of Le Pen as a relief to their plight, which will not show any respite since Macron is also a notorious Islamophobe, as is evidenced by his anti-Islamic policies restricting their freedom and liberties. The sharp divisions in the electorate show the absence of national unity in the French society that is plagued by rising inflation, unemployment, lack of proper medical care, social discrimination, and the growing immigration problem. Now, because of the war in Ukraine, an influx of Slavic refugees. For the ordinary people in France, foreign policy doesn't matter, whether in issues pertaining to the European Union or Paris' role in the affairs of what are called the Francophone countries, former colonies mostly in Africa. This means Macron, during his first time, tried to punch above his weight, especially concerning the French interference in Lebanon and to a lesser extent in Syria, will not be taken seriously in West Asia. Though, a self-imposed permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, France, whose economy and political prestige have been going down over the past decades, clearly doesn't fit the role of a major world power. Consequently, France's participation in the talks in Vienna on Iran's inalienable right to enrich uranium for peaceful purpose will not be of any significance. Despite the fact that Macron enjoys the support of the US, the non-participant in the so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. In view of the votes of the working class and other disenchanted elements of the French society garnered by the far right in the latest presidential elections, the Third Front, as the growing disgruntled section on the streets of France is being called, protests will continue throughout the country and might lead to violence. The Yellow Vest movement is expected to resume its nationwide demonstrations, and so also on the students and the civil workers against the policies of President Macron, who this time will have to bow to the pressures of the left, which cast their votes for him, not out of any sympathy, but their traditional opposition to the far right. Macron can thus do a favor to world peace and stability by ending French meddling in West Asia and Africa, as well as in Ukraine. He ought to stop all arms supplies to not just the warring sites in various parts of the African continent, but also the illegal Zionist entity, the Persian Gulf states, and to the separatists in southern Yemen who are part of the Saudi Emirati war against the government of national unity in Sana'a.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-azam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of barakah, and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this, in fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.